Last year, Illinois had historic high amounts of students studying agriculture. Today, we speak to an Illinois State Ag student and professor about the recent growth in the field. Speaking of the field, we'll be speaking to a farmer in Pasotum and Illinois Farm Bureau economist Mike Doherty about this year's harvest.
We're struggling along, really, on farm income because of this high supply without quite enough demand.
Plus, how do core Trump supporters view immigrants, refugees, and American foreign policy compared to other voters?
The opinions of Donald Trump's core supporters, especially on immigration and to a lesser extent on trade, set them apart from people who supported a different Republican candidate and from the American public at large.
That's Dina Smeltz of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs on a new survey out today looking at American public opinion of voters. We'll delve further into that. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Agriculture is big business in Illinois, and that sentiment trickles all the way down to the state's higher education. In fact, the number of students in Illinois public institutions who are working towards agricultural-related degrees has been increasing every year of the past decade. In 2015, it was the most on record. That's according to the Illinois Board of Higher Education. Nearly 3,000 college students took classes in those degree programs in 2015. Let's start with Joey Keller to talk about this issue today. He's a junior at Illinois State University, studying agricultural communications and leadership. Hey, Joey, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. What made you want to pursue an agricultural-related degree?
Well, growing up through high school, I was heavily involved in FFA, and my ag teacher going through Waverly High School really just instilled that passion in me.
Future Farmers of America, that's FFA.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And Waverly is southwest of Springfield. Does your family have an agricultural background? Is that why you joined FFA?
No. My mom's actually from Detroit. My dad's from Chicago. So I had no agricultural background growing up.
And so what was it about it that made you want to get involved in the field?
Just eighth grade is when I actually started being involved in ag. And I just saw all the leaders that were coming out of the agricultural industry, and I wanted to be a leader.
And what exactly is agricultural communications? That's what your major is, right?
Yes, ma'am. It can be everything from going to the buying stocks to going out to promoting Facebook pages.
And so Facebook pages, social media, this is for agribusiness companies or for what are you thinking about in terms of your future? Ideally, who would you like to work for?
I'd like to end up, I'm not for sure on a company yet. GrowMark was something I've been looking into. I manage my fraternity's Facebook page, promoting all our stuff that we do through them.
And have you done any internships?
I have not yet. Over the summer, I've just been going back to a farm that's right there outside of town, Meese Farms. So I've been working with those guys.
Joey, you mentioned you're the president of your fraternity. That's the Farmhouse Fraternity on the ISU campus. How is that sort of intersect with the work that you are doing in your classroom studies?
Yeah, well, being the president of Farmhouse, I'm heavily involved with all the other fraternal organizations here at campus. So I'm going out meeting all the other presidents, some of their members, just trying to build up a better bond between all the fraternities.
And do you find that when you're especially on the ISU campus, do you think that the Farmhouse fraternity intermixes a lot with other fraternities and sororities? Do the ag students, are they kind of spread throughout all the other fraternities, or do they end up in the Farmhouse fraternity?
Yeah, there's two main ag fraternities, AGR and Farmhouse. So most of the agricultural students here on campus go through them, but I'm finding more and more that students are branching out to other fraternities, too.
I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Aslihan Spalding is an agribusiness professor at ISU and is also on the line with us from Normal. Professor Spalding, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I wonder how often you're meeting students like Joey who are coming from not farming backgrounds, not farm families, who are interested in studying agriculture.
It's happening a lot and a lot more than you would think. Personally, I'm from Istanbul, Turkey. I do not have any farming background myself. But the agricultural community is very unique. I have very passionate students, hardworking students with a lot of good skills, and I love working with students like Joy.
And I wonder, how did you end up in this field then? How did you end up in this industry, Professor?
Actually, I had an internship with an agribusiness company when I was going through my undergraduate degree in Istanbul, and it was all about food marketing, and I fell in love with that. And I decided to pursue a graduate program in agribusiness because of that. So internships do help find your passion.
And when we're thinking about the students, and maybe we should start, can you first of all define what goes into an agribusiness degree? What kind of classes are the students taking? What kind of things are they ending up, hopefully, companies are they ending up working for?
Absolutely. Our program is really unique, actually, for the agribusiness management sequence. We have 10 sequences in the program, and agribusiness is one of them. And for that specific sequence, students take horticulture, agronomy, soils, livestock, animal science. They are really exposed to all aspects of agriculture as their core introduction classes. And as they go through the program, then they decide, you know, what do I want to really specialize on? And then they can take risk management, grain marketing, livestock marketing. I teach food industry marketing class. We talk about food industry and, you know, how to sell products to consumers, not just selling to farmers.
Joey, I wonder for you, as we're talking to Professor Spalding and hearing sort of about the different fields that people are going into or the different job paths people are taking, because you were involved with Future Farmers of America in high school, but maybe that you said eighth grade was sort of when you started thinking about it. Were there misconceptions that you had about agriculture before, myths that you had maybe that were dispelled now that you're studying in the field?
Yeah, one of the biggest ones that I've had is, oh, so you're just a farmer. I get that all the time from an agricultural background for talking to people that don't have that kind of background, and they just don't see how broad the agricultural world is.
And Professor Spalding, your program at ISU, you all have seen your enrollment triple since 2003 to about 630 students. What are you thinking has driven that growth?
I think in our program, the good reputation that we have out there in Illinois and about outside Illinois, and we have a lot of student organizations and clubs that they compete in national competitions, and that really raises ISU on everybody's radar. And a lot of job opportunities. And again, when Joy said just a farmer, I mean, I love that we have farmers doing what they do to feed the world. But, you know, once the farmer has the product ready to go out the farm gate, and there are more jobs out there, distribution, logistics, marketing, sales, financial aspect of it, advertising and communications. So a lot of jobs, and our career fair, we see that. When I first started about 13 years ago, we had about 30, 35 businesses coming to our agricultural career fair. And this year we had 53 businesses looking for students and network with them.
And when we think about that, Professor Spalding, I imagine what kind of job placement are you seeing for students? Is this the kind of field where with an undergraduate degree, students can go easily into work after they finish their four-year degree?
Absolutely. We do track that actually once the students graduate. And when we look at it, 99% of our graduating students have a job upon graduation or get one within the first 3 months.
Sorry, did you say 99%, Professor?
Yes, ma'am.
Wow. Yeah. And for you, Joey, was that part of your motivation also? Is that you thought that I don't know how much you thought about when you picked your major, when you thought about ag communications. Did you think about employment after college?
Oh, yeah. I've always seen the statistics that there are so many more job openings than there are students to fill those jobs.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Spalding, do you see that as well with employers that are coming on campus to Normal, to ISU campus?
Absolutely. And there are more jobs out there in agriculture than we have graduates for, according to the USDA statistics. So that's really a good position to be in. And these are high, you know, well-paying jobs, so, and good benefits packages. And we always highlight that students, you know, it's not just the salary you get out of it, but what kind of benefits you get. And a lot of businesses are very competitive in that area.
And what do you, when you say that, when you say benefits, what do you mean in particular? Are you talking about kind of the traditional benefits we'd think about in terms of retirement, insurance?
Yeah, the medical, you know, insurance aspect of it, the benefits, and also students get sign-in bonuses. Some of our students get a company truck and computer. gas mileage, those kind of things really add up. And compensation plans, obviously, for bonuses if they go above and beyond what planned.
Professor Spalding, you mentioned a lot of different. So we're talking about agriculture, agribusiness very broadly. You've mentioned a lot of different categories. You talked about marketing. There's technology. Sure. As you see the field, as we're talking about jobs and the need for people, where are the biggest growth areas and what specific subsets?
I know that agricultural technology, we always talk about the big data, but what do you do with this data? So we need a lot of students with good analytical data analysis skills. So we really see that growing. A lot of research, obviously, is booming. So a lot of more jobs out there in those fields.
And when we say agricultural technology, I think the data part people understand because you're talking, I imagine, about crunching a lot of data, whether we're thinking about actual farms and crop yields and things like that.
Absolutely.
What other technological areas are you seeing growth in agriculture?
I know it's looking at the whole package. You know, obviously, the farmers do a great job gathering data on their farms and that precision agricultural data set. And you're looking at the correlation of what they do on the farm and how it impacts the yields and how they can make more money given the limited resources and input costs.
And as you're saying that, and as we're thinking about the technology that's needed, if you're going to be what we think of, Joey, to your point, the traditional farmer, how much, if someone wanted to get into the industry now, I imagine, would you say, Professor, that you think a four-year degree is required in terms of how much technological knowledge you need?
I believe so, because our program exposes students all aspects of agriculture. So if you're working for a seed company, you still have to know what's happening in the livestock industry. So our students are exposed to the livestock industry and then animal science, animal industry management. I think students need to have a broader understanding of agricultural aspects of it, and it will take to get you to that level and having this conversation with anybody in the ag field. I think 4 years is a good program to have.
When we're thinking about programs throughout the state, I know according to the Illinois Board of Higher Education, the University of Illinois has more than 2,200 ag students. Joey, I wanted to ask you, what particularly about the program at ISU was attractive to you?
To me, it was the teachers. When I came here, because I also was thinking about going over to U of I, and when I went there, it just didn't connect with me. It was a huge campus. I didn't meet any of my teachers. But over here, when I toured with my parents, I met every single teacher. They were all willing to sit down, talk to me, really try to get to know me.
And Professor Spalding, do you feel that, I mean, as we have conversations with state university faculty or administrators, we can't help but think about the context of the state budget situation, the uncertain fiscal climate that state universities have been facing. Given that, do you feel like that, particularly if you're in ag at ISU, you all have been somewhat inoculated from that because of the growth that you've seen in the program?
I think we are really lucky to be at Illinois State University. Our upper management is doing a great job, financial management. So we were able to honor student scholarships and such, and having the strong numbers in the department really helps us too, and the university supports our program because of we have a lot of good students in the program.
But as we think about that and we're thinking about the number of students that require, for example, MAP grant funding,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have a sense of your student population, how many of them, that's a really important part of their funding for attending agricultural programs?
I'm not familiar with the departmental base, but I know as ISU, they honored all the MAP grants last year and this year. Same thing for the supporting our veteran students as well. And I know we have a few students that were veterans.
Mm-hmm. Joey, how about you? For MAP grant funding, was that something that's important to you as a student?
Yeah, getting that funding really helped me put me through with college this year. So if that was taken away, that would be very devastating to me.
Mm. And as we're talking about students and the student population, I know that we've been talking to you about your fraternity, you're president of the Farmhouse Fraternity. Are you working with a lot of the same people every day, or do you have the same people in your classes? Is it kind of a tight-knit circle that you guys have?
Yeah, I'd say the ag department tight-knit circle. In your gen eds, if you find somebody that's in the ag department, you generally go over there and sit with them. You hang out with them after class if you have a good knowing who they are.
Mm-hmm. Professor Spalding, how about in terms of the different departments at the university at ISU? What would you like to see in terms of growth? Where do you think the biggest investment needs to be in agricultural education right now?
I know the STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math, we need to invest more in those fields, and especially getting more underrepresented groups in that, like the females in STEM, minorities in STEM. I know that's something that we are paying attention to right now.
What kind of things are you doing when you're thinking about underrepresented groups? How are you trying to do encouragement of more women or other, as you said, underrepresented groups within agriculture?
Sure. Actually, as a department, we have heavily invested in our recruitment efforts. We have visited high schools and community colleges, going out to Chicago High School in Agricultural Science up in Chicago, and reaching out to those folks and be there for them as they need help from us, and attending several different conferences. I know the state FFA conference also a really good one when high school FFA students come through the program, and we really get to know students and promote our program to them through those events.
Joey, what about you? I just wonder, what do you think is the most helpful thing for getting high school students? You said you got involved in eighth grade. What's the most helpful thing for getting kids who were either eighth grade through high school interested in studying agriculture? Oh, Joey, sorry. It looks like we're losing you there with your cell phone. So we're going to have to leave it at that. But I want to thank Joey Keller, who's a junior at Illinois State University. He's studying Ag Communications and Leadership. I also want to thank Professor Aslihan Spalding. She's an agribusiness professor at ISU. She's also an advisor to the ISU National Agri-Marketing Association. Coming up on the 21st, we're going to continue our conversation talking about this year's harvest. We've got a farmer who's going to be joining us from Pasodum in southern Champaign County. And we're going to be speaking to the senior economist and policy analyst with the Illinois Farm Bureau about this year's harvest, all the economic pressures that it's facing. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Harvest season is well underway in Illinois. The Prairie State is preparing for a better than average yield this year. But that good harvest doesn't necessarily mean that farmers are going to be profiting. Joining us on the line is Chris Hausman. He's a fourth generation farmer and a director at the Illinois Farm Bureau. He's on the line with his farm. He's got about 1,500 acres of corn and soybean near the village of Pasodum in southern Champaign County. Hi, Chris. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for taking time with us. I know this is a really busy season for you right now.
Not a problem. Good morning.
Good morning. How's the harvest looking for you so far on your farm this season?
Well, actually, we dodged kind of a bullet last night. Northern half of Illinois received some pretty heavy rains, and we're able, actually, I'm calling from the combine this morning. We are harvesting soybeans as we speak, and so we've missed that rain. The clouds look a little ominous here, but we'll keep going until Mother Nature decides we're not. And so, but no, things have been going well here in southern Champaign County.
Chris, I'm just looking at the weather forecaster we have here in the studio, and I was thinking about forecasts this morning about rain. When it rains, how does that affect you guys right now with soybeans, for example? If you get a heavy rain, does that just kind of halt all of your production? How do you handle that?
Well, for soybean harvest, rain has a bigger impact than it would on corn harvest. When it rains, soybeans are really tough to cut. Where with corn, you can go out there, if it's not heavy rain, you can usually get out and harvest corn in marginal conditions. But with soybeans, you need some dry sunshine, preferably. They're a little bit more pickier than corn harvest. So when the sun is shining, you try to get out there and get your soybeans cut if they are mature enough and ripe enough for harvest.
Chris, how did the corn harvest go for you this year?
Really well. We found that the corn yields maybe weren't quite where a lot of the earlier predictors had it picked at. We were hearing earlier in the season record corn yields, but for us in this area, I think what we came in at was just about what last year's had. We were happy with that, but we didn't see those record corn yields in this immediate area. But still, I would say our corn yields were very respectable. I'm not complaining, but I don't think that the forecasters had it quite right, at least in this immediate area.
Well, and Chris, the forecasters were a lot of based on the weather conditions that we saw earlier this summer. How has the weather cooperated for you into the fall? It's been so, I mean, I think the high today in Champaign is going to be 86, which I think is kind of crazy.
Right. This whole growing season from the start till now has been what I would consider kind of not the norm. We had what I would consider not record, but very high rainfall amounts, which normally rainfall would tend to make yields go up, and that usually is the case. And this year, though, I think we had excessive rain amounts, and temperatures were a little bit on the warm side. So I don't think corn really likes warm nights in the summertime. It prefers cooler evenings, if at all possible, in the summertime. And I think that might have taken a little bit of the top-end yield out of the corn. Soybeans, on the other hand, they don't like wet feet. And I think what I'm seeing right now initially on soybean yields is that it's what I would consider average, but again, not any record yields out there. And I think the record rainfall amounts that we had this summer had something to do with that.
Chris, so you said that you feel like the when you're talking about corn and soy, you said that you think it's gone well. When we talk about a quote-unquote good harvest, are you talking, is that solely dependent on the yield that you have, or what else goes into a good harvest?
Well, I think a couple things. First of all, mechanically speaking, as long as all your equipment is functioning and you're not having major breakdowns, that's usually a good thing in harvest. Farmers, we tend to just deal with breakdowns when they occur, and we have a lot of really great dealerships in the area with some really top mechanics that are putting in some really long hours this time of year, keeping this equipment rolling. And so I would say as long as your equipment is running and no major breakdowns, that's a good day. Second then would be Mother Nature and what she deals with you. You know, you would hope that the rain would stay minimal, but sometimes the rain is good just to kind of get your maintenance items taken care of and giving everybody a break, because we tend to put some very long hours in this time of year, and we can get stressed at times, and a rain break can sometimes work out good to, you know, let everybody take a little breather and regroup.
We're speaking with Chris Houseman. He's a District 12 director with the Illinois Farm Bureau. He's actually talking to us from his combine. He's farms out near Pisotum in Champaign County. And I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Mike Dougherty is a senior economist and policy analyst for the Illinois Farm Bureau. Hey, Mike, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Thank you for having me on.
Mike, as we're listening to Chris discuss his yields, how things are going for him, how typical is that across the state? Of course, he's talking about corn and soy in Champaign County, kind of central. What are things looking like across the state this year so far?
Well, everyone's talking about the corn yields being slightly below what they were in 2014. So maybe not as high as Chris mentioned there, not as high as what was originally forecasted. We thought we were going to have an absolute record year on corn. It looks like that's not going to be a record, but it will still be a very big harvest. The bigger surprise is coming in on the soybean yields. Now, we're a long ways away from knowing, long ways away within harvest time anyway, because they're about 16% complete across Illinois on soybean harvest. So we have another week to go or two to really get a fix on estimate on the soybean yields. But that's where the surprise seems to lie, that we're looking at some possible increases in average soybean yields for the state and also for the U.S.
And I think, Chris, and you can hop in here, I think when people think about a good harvest and they think about high yields, that doesn't necessarily translate to you as a farmer a lot of profitability. Can you just explain that to everybody why that is?
Well, for profit, it takes both yield and price. And the market works based on what it's anticipating the actual production numbers are going to be. And then the trade analyzes that, and our trade speculators are out there trying to figure that out. But yields have what I or prices have been what I would consider below cost of production in most cases. And so even though we do have the yield, which is one side of the equation, price is the other part of that. And it would be what I would consider a much better harvest if we were looking at prices more in that $4 to $4.25 for corn and $10 plus on soybeans. But we're not at those levels, and so we are dealing with the current prices the way they are. But the yield is definitely going to help.
Mike, when we're thinking about prices this year, let's start with corn prices. What's factoring into corn prices, apart from obviously we have to think of Illinois in the context of not just the rest of domestic production, but global production? What's going into the corn price so far this year?
Well, there's been a lot of recovery that started back in 2012, when we had a record drought in the Midwest. And the United States being the largest exporter of corn in the world, called in. It was an incentive for other producers, particularly in Brazil and now this year coming into Argentina, to ramp up their corn production quite a bit. And so global production increased on corn to make up the difference, and that has not gone away even despite the low prices. And the other factor was is that the demand for corn really dried. It decreased quite a bit, mainly because of China filling up their inventories on corn, which they are a large corn producer. And in fact, there's even some talk that China might even sell corn. And so that has weighed in on the market as well. It's been a tapering off of the demand that was out there.
We're talking about, it's harvest time, we're talking about the harvest economy with farmer Chris Houseman, a senior economist at the Illinois Farm Bureau, Mike Doherty. Mike, what about soybean prices? What's going into soybean prices this year?
Well, fortunately, on soybeans over the last few, these are multi-year dynamics, and worldwide there's been a great demand for soybeans, mainly coming out of China. Illinois sells over half its soybeans overseas, and the number one buyer of those as a portion is China. But that also has been difficult for the United States to continue to compete in making those sales to China and to other countries because of the strength of the U.S. dollar. And also getting our crops to port is a very important part of that equation. The other countries, Brazil and particularly Argentina, has some very low production costs in terms of not only where they produce their soybeans, but also their low transportation costs in the case of Argentina to their ports. And a value with our strong value of our dollar compared to their currencies there in Argentina and Brazil, it's made it difficult for us to compete one-to-one or against them in those sales to China. So while we've been selling more, they've been outselling us. And so on, that's tapered off our price a little bit on soybeans compared to what we had 3 or 4 years ago.
And Mike, when I'm thinking about this, last time we had you on the program back on the 21st, it was back in June, and it was the day after the Brexit vote, and we were talking about the effects of Brexit on Illinois' economy, and certainly we were having a conversation about the dollar and how much that is going to impact the industry here. What are the other, so we've talked about China, are there other worldwide factors we haven't talked about that are going to be factored into prices and harvest right now this year for corn or soy?
Well, this time of the year, you know, once we start having clarity on exactly what our yields are here in throughout the Corn Belt, particularly on corn and soybeans, the next biggest factor it weighs in is how do the producers in Argentina and Brazil, particularly, how do they respond to those prices? Those prices are a function of our yields to some extent. If we have a bumper crop, if these soybean yields come in as high as some people are thinking they might, we're going to have declines in soybean prices as a result of that increased supply. That means that there will be a reaction in Argentina and Brazil to our prices. These are world prices. They're posted internationally, and they will react to those. So that's the part that is a factor that, you know, it will be weighing in on this market. We'll see what those planting conditions are like over the next few months. They have a long planting window in South America because of the number of climate zones from the north to the south that they can plant corn and soybeans in. They're already planting corn in Argentina, and they're just starting to go into the fields in Brazil on the soybeans. So we'll see how much they plant down there and what they feel they can afford to plant in terms of how much profit is left for themselves. They may back off because of these low prices, or they may say, well, we're going to take the risk and we'll plant quite a bit.
Chris, I'm thinking about you're a fourth-generation farmer, and I'm thinking about how much you are paying attention to this conversation that that Mike and I are having about the global forces. It's something obviously you are deeply involved with every day. And I wonder, when you're planting, how much do you think about how much corn? And so, like, how do you figure out what you're going to plant and how much you're going to plant based on how you think things are going to go for the year?
Well, the market does have a big factor in that. For us here, we've been pretty well 50-50 split between corn and soy. We've not really made any changes in our cropping plans based on what those prices are because we, you know, here in East Central Illinois, we're going to grow one of two crops. That's either corn or soy. And here a few years back, there were some issues with farmers growing corn on corn with maybe increased disease pressures and some other things. And a lot of farmers got away from corn on corn and went back to a corn-soy rotation. So we're kind of set right now. We don't have that third crop alternative, so we're going to be planting either corn or soybeans. And I think the other thing that needs to be mentioned that Mike has alluded to is how trade is so important. And so trade agreements are so critical to Illinois agriculture and the Midwest agriculture just because we do need free open markets, and trade agreements can be a positive thing for U.S. agriculture.
And Chris, as you say that, we just have about a minute left or so, but I'd love to hear if you think that we're having enough conversation about trade, if you feel like the agricultural community is satisfied by the trade discussions we're hearing in this upcoming presidential election.
Well, unfortunately, what we're hearing out of the presidential candidates hasn't been too positive, and that concerns us. When we start hearing about walking away from trade agreements and making them more based on just what U.S. interests are, that concerns us because trade is a two-way street, and it's got to be give and take. And so I'm hoping that our presidential candidates will keep trade on their top agenda, especially for Midwest agriculture.
Well, yeah, we'll see if we continue to have those conversations. Chris Houseman, thanks for joining us. I know it's a busy time of year for you. He's farms about 1,500 acres of corn and soybean near the village of Posotum in southern Champaign County. Thanks for taking the time with us, Chris.
You're welcome, and have a good day.
Thank you. You too. I want to thank as well Mike Dougherty, Senior Economist and Policy Analyst with Government Affairs and Commodities Division at the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mike, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Speaking of the presidential candidates, coming up on the 21st, we're going to be talking to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. They've just put out a big survey this morning, actually a big news conference in Washington, looking at survey opinions of all Americans about foreign policy issues, about trade, about immigration and refugees. We're going to be delving into all of that coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've heard a lot about American attitudes about refugees, immigrants, globalization this election cycle. But what do Americans actually think about all of this? That's the point of a wide-ranging survey that was released earlier today by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. They're a nonpartisan group established in 1922 that seeks to provide insight on critical global issues. And it turns out, at least according to this survey, while core Trump supporters have very strong views on these issues, those issues are not shared by the majority of Americans. We're joined now by Craig Kafura, a research associate with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, one of the co-authors of this new report. It's titled America in the Age of Uncertainty. Welcome to the 21st, Craig. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
You all surveyed a random sample of more than 2,000 people for this. First of all, I think it's important to note, how did you decide who was a, quote, core Trump supporter versus a core Hillary supporter or just a Democrat or Republican?
That's a really good question. So we wanted to split out core Trump supporters to focus on them because they've been driving so much of the debate on so many of these issues. So to identify core Trump supporters, what we call a core Trump supporter is someone who said that Donald Trump was their top choice for president. When we gave them a list of a number of candidates, including Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, and so forth. Among those that we surveyed, about 32% of Republicans, 15% of independents, and even 3% of Democrats fell into this category, saying that Trump was their top choice for president. We do the same thing for Hillary Clinton supporters or Sanders supporters. We can look at each of those groups.
And you all had a panel this morning in Washington where one of the speakers said that Trump supporters were, in a sense, turbocharged Republicans, in the sense that these views have been around for a while. Do you think that's an accurate depiction?
It is. So there's a reason, of course, that Trump was able to dominate the Republican primaries, and that's because he appealed to Republican voters on some of these issues that they care about quite a bit. So immigration, for example. Republicans are much more likely than Democrats to describe large numbers of immigrants and refugees coming into the United States as a critical threat to the U.S. That graph has been growing over the last 15 years, and we now see it as at its largest point since the Council has been asking on this issue almost 20 years.
And I'm sorry, the largest point saying that immigrants are a critical threat?
That large numbers of immigrants and refugees coming to the U.S., yes.
And did you separate that out, the difference between immigrants or refugees, or did you ask, did you group them together?
This year it was combined.
Okay. And so those historic highs, those are among Republican supporters or Republican people who self-identified as Republican?
Yes. So in our sample, 67% of Americans who said that they were a Republican described this as a critical threat. Now, only 43% of Americans overall said the same thing. And only 27% of Democrats said so. So this is, at 40 points, that's the biggest gap we've seen in our polling in almost 20 years.
Wow. Okay. What are the other critical threats? You've surveyed supporters on these, quote, top three critical threats.
Mm-hmm.
What were those, first of all?
So the top threat that everyone is concerned about, this is the overall number one threat, and it's really up there for Republicans, Democrats, Independents, is terrorism. So 3 in 4 Americans overall say this is a critical threat, more than 8 in 10 Republicans, 7 in 10 Independents. It's obviously been in the news a lot. It's at the top of everyone's mind. And that's also true for core Trump supporters. 83% of core Trump supporters say that terrorism is a critical threat. It's the highest for any of the threats. Nuclear proliferation is always a major issue for Americans. It's come up in both the first presidential debate and the vice presidential debate so far. And that's because it's a major issue for Americans. 60% of Democrats say it's a critical threat. 66% of Republicans, 57% of Independents. This is another one of these issues that is always on Americans' minds. And then there are some issues that aren't as shared. So for Democrats, that's climate change. They see this as a major threat, and Republicans don't. Conversely, Republicans see immigration as a major threat, and Democrats disagree.
Let's talk about immigration for a minute, because there's this whole idea of a pathway to citizenship, how to grapple with the estimated 11 million or so people who don't have legal authorization to be in the U.S. And that's one area of this survey that I thought had some really interesting results in terms of what that pathway should look like. First of all, it's probably not a surprise what core Trump supporters said, right, in terms of your research. What percentage was it specifically that said that they thought people should leave their jobs and leave the country?
You're right. It wasn't out of surprise, given their views on immigrant groups and their view of immigration overall. 63% of core Trump supporters said that illegal immigrants working in the United States should be required to leave their jobs and the U.S. That goes along with their general support for example, building more border wall and fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border or decreasing illegal immigration.
And how does that compare to other Republicans who don't self-identify as core Trump supporters?
They're actually quite a bit different. So only 42% of Republicans say the same thing. It's not quite, it's the most common response, but it makes it less than a majority. So more Republicans are likely to support some way for the unauthorized population to stay in the U.S., either with a path to citizenship or with work permits, but no path to citizenship.
And then I imagine the Democrats would have greeted with that also, the majority of Democrats, right?
Yes, and Democrats are even more strongly in favor of a path to citizenship than Americans overall. Nearly 2 in 3 Democrats say that the unauthorized population should be able to pursue citizenship either immediately or after paying a penalty and waiting some number of years.
And that said, then, Craig, what do you think the majority American opinion is about how to deal with people who don't have legal authorization to be here?
So we've seen in our polling repeatedly throughout the years that there's general public support for what's commonly called comprehensive immigration reform, or CIR. And that's a policy package that combines both a path to citizenship for unauthorized immigrants, some set of penalties and waiting periods. Sometimes it includes English classes as part of the citizenship course. There's also increased border security. A package like that came up in 2013 in the Senate. It passed the Senate, but it stalled in the House. But in general, when we've asked about these sorts of package arrangements, you get support from both Democrats and Republicans. Democrats get the path to citizenship that they really support, and Republicans get the commitment to border security that's important to them.
I'm speaking with Craig Cafura. He's a research associate with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He's actually joining us from Washington because that's where they had the release of their new report titled America in the Age of Uncertainty. Big survey of lots of opinions about Americans about foreign policy. We've been talking about immigration. We'll tweet out all of those links if you would like to see more. There's lots of charts and graphics for those of you who love to see all of those. Follow 21st Show. That's 21ST Show for that. Craig, I wanted to talk about trade for a moment. We were actually just speaking to a farmer about harvest time. And he was saying that one of the things that was most disappointing to him about this presidential campaign was the lack of discussion by presidential candidates about trade. We have heard a lot about TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I feel like before we even talk about that, can you just explain what TPP is? Because I think a lot of people have heard this and not heard explanations of it.
Sure. So the TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a 12-nation free trade agreement among a number of nations, mostly in Asia, but it's really around the whole Pacific Rim. So it includes countries like Japan and Australia and the United States and Vietnam, but also countries like Chile and Peru, countries that you wouldn't necessarily think of as being part of the Pacific, but they're around the rim. It's grown out of originally a small four-member agreement, and it's kind of snowballed from there.
And do you think it's accurate to say that most of the trade discussions we've heard during this political campaign season have revolved around TPP?
Yes, most of them have revolved around both TPP and linking TPP to NAFTA and discussions about how NAFTA went in the 90s.
And that gets to sort of a really interesting survey point about attitudes about trade and globalization. Can we start with trade first and just what opinions look like and is there a difference of opinion between Republicans and core Trump supporters about trade?
Yes. So core Trump supporters are more negative on trade than Republicans are overall. But we found generally a pretty strong support for international trade on a number of areas. So most Americans, including a majority of Republicans, say that international trade is good for the U.S. economy. They say it's good for consumers like them, and it's good for their own standard of living. But we do see more negative attitudes when it comes to jobs, particularly when it comes to creating jobs in the U.S. and for American workers' job security. That's where we really see negative attitudes come out.
How did you measure that? How did you ask about how people felt about? Because I think when we say globalization, and we've heard so many conversations about tapping into sort of anti-globalization sentiment, but what did you guys actually look at?
So we have a couple questions on all of these topics. Our question on globalization is pretty straightforward. It says, Do you believe that globalization, especially the increasing connections of our economy with others around the world, is mostly good or mostly bad for the United States? It's a very general question, but it gives us a sense of how Americans think about kind of these big issues. And then to get more specifics on international trade, we asked about whether Americans thought international trade was good or bad for various issues. So that's where we get sets on, you know, trade for the U.S. economy or for consumers like them or for American companies.
I want to switch topics for a minute here because, Craig, we've been talking so much about Trump supporters and the difference we've seen with Trump supporters to the Republican Party. But what did this survey show about sentiments expressed by both core, I don't know if there were core Clinton supporters or core Sanders supporters. Is it as big of a gulf between Sanders and Clinton supporters as some people have made it out to be?
No, that was actually one of the more surprising findings in the survey. We expected to find much greater differences, especially on issues of globalization and trade, between supporters of Sanders and Clinton. And we just didn't find those. There are some differences, but they're differences of degree rather than really big differences of kind. So, for example, on the TPP, we found that 56% of core Sanders supporters said they favored the TPP. And we were really shocked by this because so much of the debate, especially in the primaries, was about Senator Sanders attacking Secretary Clinton for her past support for the TPP. But then in our data, we see consistent support for these sorts of agreements.
Was it surprising to you that when you looked at this report, how much of are we as far apart as we think we are on issues based on this survey? I'm talking not just about Democrats, but Republicans, too.
No, so that was another sort of reassuring finding, right? After all of the nasty debates, after all of the mudslinging for this campaign, on a lot of major foreign policy issues, there's a lot of overlap between the parties. And this has traditionally been true. Foreign policy has traditionally been seen as something that's a little bit different than domestic politics, that politics don't go beyond the water's edge. Now, that's not always true. The Iraq War obviously became a huge political issue, and you saw big divergences of opinion between Republicans and Democrats. And there are some differences between how Democrats and Republicans want to approach international issues. Republicans are more likely to want to use military force. Democrats are more likely to want to negotiate. But in general, they share common goals and they see common threats. So going back to where we started with terrorism, everyone agrees that terrorism is a critical threat. Everyone agrees that nuclear proliferation is a critical threat. They see common threats from North Korea, for example. They just differ a little bit in how to combat terrorism or how to combat the threat of North Korea's nuclear program.
Craig, do you have any idea why, for example, when we're thinking about supporters and they're thinking about support, for example, of the TPP, do you have a way to measure what issues are most important for people? For example, if they core Trump supporters maybe don't agree with him on trade, but they do agree with him on immigration, did this survey show that?
You can sort of parse that out by looking at how different groups of people respond to the different questions. So, for example, everyone, you know, almost 80%, 90% of Trump supporters agree with him on these immigration questions. They are all in line on, yes, these people are a threat. Yes, we should build a wall. These kind of the really core issues to the campaign. When you see kind of these divisions on issues like globalization or on TPP, or another example would be on NATO, half of Trump supporters say that NATO is essential to U.S. security, which doesn't really fit with the campaign rhetoric we've heard from that campaign. That's how we can kind of figure out which issues are really, really important to supporters. And pretty clearly in our data, it comes through that immigration is the issue that's really motivating his supporters, that's really driving that debate.
Craig, we just have about a minute or so left, but I just wonder what your takeaway is from all of this really deep survey data you've done, how this kind of compares to the rhetoric, the passion, the anger that we've seen in public discussion around this presidential campaign.
So I think the thing to keep in mind is it doesn't just matter for this election. This election will be over, you know, in almost a month, thankfully. But these people are still going to be around, like, these views didn't come out of nowhere. These views have been sitting around for quite a while. We've seen these gaps between the parties on issues like immigration growing steadily over the last 15 to 20 years. And even though this election cycle might have been the one that really brought out these divisions and brought out some of this rhetoric, it's likely to come back. Trump has proven that that a candidate can rise very swiftly and really dominate the field through some of this rhetoric. I'd be surprised if no one else tried it.
That's Craig Cofora, Research Associate with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Thanks for being with us, Craig.
Thank you, Nyla.
Tomorrow we're going to be talking about brain games, whether they improve your memory or if they have any practical benefit at all. But I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.